every bit as beautiful as the rumors. Riley was certain she would know all about him, or she would know what Russian intelligence wanted the world to know. She would have too much class to say anything about it, but the fact this woman was aware about the scandal that wrecked his life hung over this meeting like a weight. But Riley told himself he wouldn't let that threaten his authority. He chatted with the gorgeous blonde for a few minutes, a professional conversation about superficial matters, her flight and her hotel and her impressions of the city and the United States. He found her to be intelligent, but highly guarded. Finally, he got around to the subject of today's meeting. "I know Duke talked to you about the Valley Floor assignment."
"He did."
"It's not a bad posting," he said. "You'll be less than 40 miles from Vegas, so you can commute in each morning. You'll have to, really, no other options in the area. We'll put you up in a nice hotel and take good care of you. The first week or so, you're just there to establish yourself. You'll get the training on the diagnostic equipment here before heading over, so all you'll be doing is looking at readouts on machinery at the rare earth hydro-separation facility. Our science and tech department will give you a cell phone that has the ability to pull the software we want directly off the system servers, but you'll have to social engineer the password out of a systems administrator to obtain the access necessary."
"I can manage that."
"Undoubtedly," Riley said. "New World Metals has a shipment of ore processing equipment heading to North Korea this month, and the computers will fly in from Europe, so we do have some time constraints. This is all machinery for the refinery. All of the mining machinery is already there."
"Where did they get that?"
"The Chinese were tossed out in such a hurry they weren't able to take everything with them. They didn't leave enough equipment to operate the mine in any profitable capacity, but they do have some drilling going on. The processing equipment is crucial now because the ore is starting to back up."
"Then I won't delay another moment to get started."
"Excellent. I have a trainer flying into New York today, a woman from Brazil who works for Vale, a diversified metals mining concern there. She does just exactly the same thing you will be doing at the Newcorp facility. You'll have 3 days to work with her and make yourself legitimate. I trust you can pull that off." Veronica had been slipping into and then out of roles for her entire career. She'd been a hotel desk clerk and a software engineer and a fishmonger and a college professor and even a bikini model at a Le Mans race. 72 hours of intense prep could turn her into just about anything, as long as scrutiny by experts wasn't too high.
"I'll do my best," she said.
Riley looked into his teacup for a moment. "I'll ask you the question Duke won't ask. How does it make you feel to know your work will directly benefit North Korea?" Martell was as calculating as Riley was off the cuff.
"I don't concern myself with that."
"Good answer. Bloody lie, but I'll take a lie that says what I want to hear. I know you were face-to-face with the DPRK agents in Vietnam. That was a poorly handled mess, and not my doing. You won't see that level of unprofessionalism on this operation with me in charge, I can assure you of that. I also want you to understand what we are doing here. The end game is mining. Money for New World Metals, and some trickle-down for us at Sharps. We are not employees of the North Koreans. We are not doing anything we can't be proud of." Martell considered mentioning the American employee of Sharps's whose blood she'd wiped off of the passport. But she decided against it. Riley wanted to start fresh in this operation, and she felt the same way. There was no reason to reintroduce any ugly issues. She wanted him to understand he wouldn't have to worry about her morale on this job. It was just a job, like all the others.
"Mr. Riley, I appreciate the gesture you seem to be making, but don't feel like you need to tend to my morale. I honestly don't give a damn what we are doing, who we are doing it for, or who we are doing it to. You have quite ably outlined my duties at Valley Floor, and I will comply to the best of my ability. You can rest assured I require no more special care than that.
I feel exactly the same way. We are men and women in a line of work where morality only gets in the way.
That's a good way of putting it, Mr. Riley.
Edward Riley's face slipped into an easy grin. You and I are going to get along perfectly, Ms. Martell.
Chapter 21.
The conference room in the Situation Room below the West Wing began filling with principals before 9 a.m. The president arrived soon after, and he waved the 11 men and women in front of him back to their seats. The focus of today's discussion, as written on the agenda and left at each place setting, was almost comically simplistic. United Nations sanctions options in pursuit of solutions re-North Korea. The United States and the United Nations had spent most of the past 70 years pursuing solutions re-North Korea, and when Ryan noticed the heading on his briefing paper, he let out a slight groan and mumbled that he sure hoped they'd have their solution figured out before lunch. In front of him at the table was his national security staff, mostly, but also his Secretary of Commerce and the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, as well as his Chief of Staff, Arnie Van Dam. The conference began with a discussion by Jay Canfield of the specific tactics the North Koreans were using to move money from banks in the Cayman Islands and Singapore, where large deposits had been made, to smaller accounts in Brunei, Antigua, Mexico, Singapore, and other locations. It was clear several large payments had been made in the past few months, but the CIA did not have the access into the banking systems to know where the money had gone. After a lot of detailed and often arcane explanations, Canfield wrapped up his presentation in plain speak.
Suffice it to say, Mr. President, that somebody is paying North Korea a hell of a lot of money, and North Korea, in turn, is wasting no time in blowing a hell of a lot of money. Who is paying them and the full scope of what they are buying is still unknown to us.
Next, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Danielle Rush, laid out her proposal, developed along with the Secretaries of State, Commerce, and Treasury, to seek a U.N. resolution enhancing existing economic sanctions against the state of North Korea. The President listened to the 20-minute presentation in silence. When it was over, Ryan slid his fingers under his eyeglasses and rubbed his tired eyes.
I get that we need to stop these transactions. I just don't see what the hell we will achieve by going to the United Nations for another round of economic sanctions on Korea. All this talk about what the United Nations is going to do, the UN can't do anything. It's not an enforcement body. It relies on its member nations to enforce sanctions. What makes you think all these countries that are making money off of North Korea will comply with the new sanctions?
Secretary of State Scott Adler fielded this.
We come out very strongly and say any nation who knowingly circumvents the sanctions will meet with unilateral sanctions from the U.S. Commerce Department. We make a big noise about getting our European and Asian partners on board with this. Once we have the U.N. stamp on this action, we can add our own measures to make it more effective.
There was a half hour of back and forth after this. Discussions of the tenor and the tone of the sanctions. Finally, President Ryan was sold on the fact this was a necessary step. He nodded and said, "Okay." You almost never hear me say this, but I agree the United Nations has an important role to play here. The U.S. and Europe already sanction our banks against working with the North Koreans, but the banks we have identified as being involved in this are all in countries not saddled by their own domestic sanctions against North Korea. Ambassador Rush said,
"We need wording along the lines of a prohibition on commerce and banking, restrictions to third-country persons, banks, and other commercial entities from facilitating trade with North Korea. We'll have to specify the 38 accounts we've identified, all the go-betweens, all the countries involved."
Ryan agreed. That's right.
We have to shut down North Korea's access to hard currency. The best way in the short term to do that is to get a UN resolution sanctioning the banks abroad they are working with now. The UN ambassador said, "If we, as a member of the UN Security Council, push for these new sanctions, the first step that will happen will be in the Security Council Sanctions Committee. They will have 10 days to hold a rules vote to see if the measures requested meet the requirements of UN economic sanctions. This is a procedural vote, and it shouldn't be a major problem, but it is a definite hurdle. There is a lot of arcane wording in the Charter, and the UN officials in the Sanctions Committee must themselves decide if the request is even valid." Ryan said, "We can put pressure on the governments of the delegates." Ambassador Rush shook her head. "Won't work. In the sanctions vote, sure, the ambassadors will vote in the interests of their own nations. But in this rules vote, the voters are employees of the UN. Simple bureaucrats. I'm not saying they're untouchable, but they are international law experts, and they pride themselves on reading the charter and ruling accordingly." Ryan nodded. "Okay. Get started on drafting the sanctions immediately. I want something to sign as soon as possible so we can get the ball rolling. Every day North Korea has all this cash and all these bank accounts and all these offshore banks is another day closer to their acquisition of an ICBM." "Mr. President," Adler said, "I want you to be perfectly clear on one thing. When you go forward with this push to get another round of sanctions passed, you will be outnumbered. There are a lot of countries and a lot of very powerful companies who were aware that North Korea has potential in the rare earth mineral sector. The big technology firms want electromagnets for their computers, for example, and the nations who get tax dollars from these firms, the French and the Germans and the Japanese and the Taiwanese, for example, they will all be under a lot of pressure to kill these sanctions." Ryan chuckled. "I've been outnumbered before. Hell, I've spent the last hour and a half staring back at you guys arguing this over." The room broke into laughter. Adler smiled, but stayed on point. "Diplomatically, politically, even ethically, we're going to look pretty awful if word gets out we're trying to inhibit an industry that has nothing to do with either weapons or human rights abuses. We will basically be saying to the world that we want to continue to starve a population of 25 million people in order to protect ourselves." Ryan said, "You know that's bullshit. Nobody in North Korea who is starving now is going to get a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken when the government mineral mine starts producing." Arnie followed Adler's argument. "But that's how it will play in the press if we push to cut off their access to manufactured goods from abroad. Politically, Mr. President, this is a dead end." Ryan heaved. "I don't do politics anymore. I won my last election, and I can't run again. You remember that, don't you?" Van Damme rolled his eyes at the comment. "I'm not talking about you. Midterms are coming up. You've got a tenuous hold on Congress and a contested Senate. If you concentrate on issues that move the needle in our favor, you can write your own ticket for the last 2 years of your administration. The populace focuses on the shiny objects in front of them. The media is talking about domestic issues first, then the Russia-Ukraine problem, and lastly the conflagration in the Middle East. North Korea's craziness isn't even a blip on the radar to these people anymore, even with the missile test and the interdiction of the rocket tubes from France. That was barely a one news cycle story. The country doesn't care." "It's not my job to just focus on what's trending, Arnie. You know that. Just because this problem isn't as overt as some of the other world flashpoints, it doesn't mean I can just ignore it." "Fair enough," Van Damme said. "But be warned, you won't have a lot of friends on this issue." Chapter 22. The Hindley Associates Gulfstream G550 flew overnight from Baltimore Washington International Airport to Václav Havel Airport, Prague. The aircraft had a range of well over 5,000 miles, so the 4,200-mile transoceanic flight was an easily makeable jaunt for the jet, without any need to stop along the way to refuel. On board the flight, the needs of Jack Ryan, Dom Caruso, and Gavin Beery were attended to by Adara Sherman. She brought them drinks after takeoff, and the three passengers sat at the four-seat conference table in the center of the cabin so they could prep for the operation ahead. The plan for the men during tonight's flight over was to use the time to acquaint themselves with the area they would be operating in Prague. Karl Skala lived in the Žižkov district of the city, far to the east of the tourist traps of the old town and Hradčany. It was a large area of apartment buildings, working-class neighborhoods, and municipal parks, and the men knew if they were going to run any kind of a surveillance package on their target there, they would need to know the area without having to walk around with their nose in a map. The service they were using on their laptops tonight to acquaint them with the eastern neighborhoods of Prague was state-of-the-art. Gavin had recently briefed the operators of the campus about the new application from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency that now ran on their computers. It was called Map of the World, and it was an incredibly detailed interactive mapping service that could show the team virtually any place on Earth, and also give them an easy interface through which they could pull up all data on the area known by the U.S. Intelligence Agency and the other members of the Five Eyes, the English-speaking countries who shared intelligence product with the United States. Map of the World contained millions of pieces of information culled from open sources, as well as the intelligence organizations from the United States, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. They spent time testing Map of the World by researching their target's apartment building. Through a few clicks, they could see the facade, the parking area in the rear, photos of inner corridors, security camera angles and schematics, and even information on tenants of the building in the form of the computerized rental agreements kept on file by the property manager. Map of the World was an incredible resource, like Google Earth on steroids, and Jack and Dom knew it would replace Eagle View, the high-tech mapping program they had been using. Eagle View was good, but it wasn't going to tell you what time a particular trash bin on a particular street corner was emptied. Map of the World could do that, provided someone in the U.S. intelligence community had entered that bit of intel from any linked intelligence or open-source database. Gavin Beery had loaded a mobile version of the service onto Jack and Dominic's iPhones for quick reference while in the field, and he was even testing out a proprietary application he had created himself, whereby the operators could speak commands into their phones and have answers computed for them using MOTW information and then read aloud back to them. As they ate their dinner and discussed the capabilities of the software, Gavin asked Jack to give it a try. "What do I ask?" "Whatever you want. Like I said, she's still in beta, so don't be too rough on her." Jack thought for a moment, then pushed the button on his mobile. "MOTW," he said, letting the computer know he was talking to the Map of the World app. "Tell me which airport in Prague has the least police presence." All eyes in the cabin looked at the mobile. After just a few seconds, a female voice replied, "I am sorry. I do not understand." Jack made a face at Gavin. "Sorry, Gav, but I don't think this is quite ready for a field test." But Beery snatched the phone out of Jack's hand. He said, "MOTW, how many police officers are at Václav Havel Airport in Prague?" Another brief pause, and then, in a slightly computerized voice, the mobile replied, "Exact answer unknown. There is a municipal police precinct at Václav Havel Airport, a federal police station at Václav Havel Airport, and an airport police office at Václav Havel Airport. Shall I give you terminal locations, phone numbers, or email addresses?" Jack and Dom both raised their eyebrows. Gavin smiled. "There are millions of bits of data at its disposal. You ask the right question in the right way, and it can be of use." Dom joked, "Now that we've got this, what the hell do we need you for?" Gavin rolled his eyes and went back to his dinner, and Adara refilled everyone's wine glass. After dinner, Adara cleared the table and offered coffee to the three men. Ryan and Beery never hesitated to thank Adara for her great service and even ask her if there was anything they could do to help out on the journey. But Caruso was the only passenger on tonight's flight who actually spent time up in the galley at the front of the cabin, helping with the dishes and the linens. Neither Gavin nor Jack noticed it because they were engrossed in their work, but Caruso spent a lot of time on the flight over to Europe up front, chatting with Sherman. The G-550 landed at 9 a.m., and the three men of the campus climbed into a black Mercedes E-Class sedan Sherman had arranged to be waiting for them at the hangar, where they parked after clearing customs. They threw in several pieces of luggage, and then drove directly through morning traffic to Prague's 3rd District. The workup Ryan had done on Scala over the past day gave the team some basic information about the man, but not much illumination into his habits and movements. Since Scala worked out of two different offices in two different locations, Ryan decided that in order to keep their operation simple, they wouldn't try to surveil him at work. That seemed like it would be a 50-50 prospect at best. Instead, they would watch the man at home, tail him as he left the house, and spend a couple days determining his habits and movements before proceeding, unless, of course, some great opportunity presented itself earlier. The goal was to get a look inside whatever personal electronics he carried with him, in the hopes there were trackbacks to Hazleton and others that might give them an idea about who killed the American ex-CIA officer. Jack thought they might be able to lift Scala's mobile phone during his daily commute. He and Dominic had recently trained in pickpocketing under a master of the art in Las Vegas, so they had some confidence in their skills, and they thought they might be able to relieve Scala of his phone while he stood on the metro or at a stoplight. If they could do this, there would be no need to resort to heavier measures. That said, heavier measures were not off the table. Ryan knew he might have to go overt on this trip, to confront Carl Scala and impress upon him the need for his cooperation, or else to simply mug him and steal his phone. At this point, there was no thought of breaking into his home because, Ryan reasoned, Scala wouldn't leave his laptop or his mobile phone there when he left the house. For now, they would take their time, eye the target to find the best opportunity to close on him, and take it from there. In most cases, campus operators in the field did not carry firearms, but it had been decided by Clark that, due to the surprising dangers that had presented themselves in Vietnam, both Dom and Jack would carry pistols during their operation in the Czech Republic. Going armed internationally was problematic. Getting into any country with guns would have been impossible if they hadn't been flying in their own jet. Even with the Gulfstream, it was necessary to take measures to ensure the guns would stay hidden while customs and immigration looked the plane over after landing. This wasn't hard. Special hidden compartments had been built into the G-550 behind existing access panels in the cabin and cockpit, and once the inspection by customs and immigration was complete, Jack and Dom had simply retrieved their weapons from their hiding places and secreted them on their person. Now both men wore subcompact Smith & Wesson M&P Shield 9mm auto pistols in covert carry pouches under their pants. The holsters had the clever brand name of Thunderwear, because the gun rode just above the wearer's crotch. Back in the States, Clark had made the operators train for hours with the Thunderwear and the small and thin handguns. Dom and Jack had each practiced drawing their weapons from inside their pants hundreds of times. Dom could complete his draw stroke and hit a target's center mass at a range of 7 yards in 0.85 seconds. Ryan got his time down to 1.01. Even with the difficulties of presenting a weapon from deep concealment, their times were faster than most police officers could pull their guns from their duty belts and fire them. Gavin, in contrast to the younger men with him on this trip, did not have a gun, which bothered him considerably. As a consolation prize, Caruso gave Gavin a less-than-lethal self-defense device for the trip. He took Gavin's iPhone and snapped on a new battery backup case for it. The case appeared to be thicker than normal and more robust than the model Gavin had been using, but Dom showed him how the device worked, and he saw that it was no regular phone protector. Instead, by thumbing open a rubber cap on the side of the case and pressing a small red button under it, the case turned into a 7.8 million volt stun device. There was only enough juice to deliver 1 3-second jolt, and, Dom explained to Gavin when he gave him the device, the power and efficacy of stun guns has been greatly exaggerated in movies and television, but it was a fair last-ditch defensive option in the right set of circumstances for a man with no other weapons and no hand-to-hand skills. Both Ryan and Caruso had been offered similar stun devices from the technology and outfitting department at the campus, but they turned them down. Both men decided they'd get better results punching a man in the nose than they would shocking him in the neck, and since they were expert martial artists, they had the training to accomplish this. Scala lived alone in a two-bedroom unit on the fifth floor of a middle-class apartment building on Christianova Street, just a couple of blocks west of Olseny Cemetery. Ryan had secured an overwatch nearby. He used a campus front company registered in Luxembourg to arrange a 3-month lease on a sixth-floor converted warehouse office space on nearby Baranova Street. The windows on the southern side of the office space gave the men a view of the entrance to Scala's building and the parking lot next to it, but they couldn't see into the windows of his condo without going up onto the roof and exposing themselves. So instead, they placed a wireless camera and a long-range laser microphone on the roof, protected under a rubber container with holes cut to allow the devices a way to see the windows across the intersection. The audio and video feeds would be picked up by Beery's computers, and it would give the men downstairs another set of eyes and ears on their target location. They set up their 3-man static surveillance operation in the corner of the office space and hid the operation from the rest of the big room by stacking desks 6 feet high. Once they had their space, from a suitcase they pulled a pair of binoculars and mounted it onto a tripod. The lenses were centered and focused on the entrance to Scala's apartment building and the parking lot next to it. The men also pointed a second directional microphone out an open window, and they hung bedding in the windows so no one looking up from the street below would see any hint of the team. They also laid 2 bedrolls, placed rubber doorstops at the entrances to the locked office to supplement the deadbolt lock, and they attached 2 large photos of Carl Scala to the curtain near the binoculars so they could study his face in their downtime. Gavin placed one of his laptops on a desk, and the other he kept in a backpack by the door. Jack had explained that he would need to come along if they tailed the government official through the streets or metro of Prague, because if the operators were able to take possession of the man's mobile, then they wanted Gavin close by and ready to hack the device and download all the data as quickly as possible. In an ideal scenario, they all agreed, they would get the phone back into Scala's pocket without him ever knowing anything was amiss. Jack told Gavin he needed to be prepared for anything, however, because most scenarios don't come off the way the planners hope. Jack had been the planner of this mission, and he had the good sense to build some wiggle room into his operation wherever he could. Jack, Dom, and Gavin were set up and in position by 3 p.m. The laser mic picked up no noise at all from inside Scala's apartment, so they were reasonably sure he wasn't home. This was no surprise. They assumed he'd return from work sometime after 5, so they settled in to wait. While they sat there, Gavin did some research into Map of the World on his computer, and he used the basic data about Scala there to hack into his condo rental records. From this, he saw their target owned a white VW Golf. The license plate was noted on the rental record, but Gavin couldn't find any information about whether or not Scala had a reserved parking space at his building on Christianova. Caruso used the binoculars on the tripod to look for a car matching the description in the parking lot adjacent to the apartment building. He found the white Golf quickly, and although he couldn't see the tag number from his position, he thought it likely to be their target's vehicle. This was odd, because this was a work day, and they had assumed Scala to be at work right now. Caruso said, probably took the metro to work. That was a convenient theory, but by 7 p.m., when they had seen no one who looked anything like their man coming in or leaving the apartment, they had their doubts.
and when midnight came and went without a single sighting of their target or any noise from inside the apartment, their concern grew. The men passed the time speculating. It was the most common game to play on a stakeout. Any thoughts that their man might have stayed to work late in the office diminished with each passing hour. Scala wasn't married, so they wondered if he stayed over at a girlfriend's place. Or a boyfriend. Ryan didn't know enough about his target to make any real assumptions about his life. The team slept in shifts, one man up, two men down, 2 hours each, all through the night. At 9 the next morning, Scala still had not shown himself, and the men braced themselves to wait through the workday for another chance to see the man they'd flown halfway around the world to target. The lengthy surveillance was tougher on Gavin than it was on the younger men. Dom had well over a decade of experience on surveillance operations, both with the FBI and then in his career with the campus. He'd gotten used to the boredom, the exhausting concentration necessary for the work, and the poor sleep and bad food that came along with the job when the target, not the watcher, was in control of the daily schedule and activities. Ryan had spent considerably less time living this arduous life, but in the past few years it seemed to him that a key component to his job involved sitting for hours in a parked vehicle, or days in a cramped and darkened room, eating takeout or cold food in plastic wrap and smelling the breath and sweat of one of his teammates. He didn't much care for the downtime, but he very much did love the thrill of the chase and the payoff of succeeding in his mission, and that made all the downtime worthwhile. Gavin had decades of experience with bad food and weird sleeping hours. This came from his life as a sedentary IT expert. But the frustrations inherent with having no idea when you needed to be awake, where you might need to go, and what you might need to do from minute to minute, took a real toll on him, and sleeping in a thin blanket curled up on a hardwood floor made the 56-year-old's back and neck cramp in protest. When Scala didn't come home after 24 hours of surveillance, they realized their plan to follow him from his house wasn't going to work. The bastard must have been out of town. From the very beginning of the surveillance, Jack and Dom had bandied around the idea of doing a quick entry on Scala's building, not to go to his apartment, but instead to break into his mailbox, which they knew from the images on map of the world would be down in the lobby. But they'd initially decided against it. Neither of them expected for a second that some letter relevant to the Hazleton situation would be sitting in the mailbox, so the probability of scoring anything useful would be low, and if something bad and unexpected happened on this op and things went loud, it would take only one nosy neighbor to remember the guy in the lobby who didn't belong. Both Jack and Dom had experienced plenty of Murphy's Law rearing its ugly head at the wrong time while on the job, so they made the decision to leave the mailbox alone. But now, it wasn't a question of discovering useful intel. It was simply a case of trying to find out where the hell Scala was. A look inside his box would certainly tell them if someone had been picking up his mail, and it would give them another piece of the puzzle. Dom was chosen to do the walkthrough. While both men had become excellent at lockpicking in the past few years, Dom was slightly better at it. The tiny tumbler lock of the mailbox wouldn't be any challenge at all for him. He made entry on the apartment building at 1 p.m. by holding the door for two movers, delivering an antique wooden table, and then following them inside. There were two people in the small and soulless lobby when the movers disappeared into the elevator, but Dom walked and acted like he belonged, and no one looked up at him. He went directly to Scala's box, which had his name in handwritten block letters on the tab over the lock, and he picked it with one hand, as if the two-piece pick set were a single key. It took him 12 seconds, and when the box popped open, he immediately shut it again and locked it back up, without removing anything. 10 minutes later, he was a half block away, back in the 6th-floor office space. Ryan asked, "What did you learn?" It was crammed full. He hasn't been here in a few days at least. "Damn," said Ryan.
This has been an epic waste of time.
Not necessarily, Caruso countered. That lobby was dead. We already know where the cameras are from Map of the World. How about we make something happen?
Jack understood. You want to go take a peek at his place?
Dom nodded. We go right now, before people get home from work. Gavin had been silent. He was out of his element here, but he was curious, so he asked, Why don't you do it late at night? Caruso replied, Why? Everybody is home then. Sounds are amplified because there's less ambient noise. Anyone sees us and they wonder what we're doing, whereas if we go now and act like we're supposed to be there, nobody will give us a second glance. Gavin understood, then said, If you want, I can disable the security cameras. Ryan cocked his head. Really? How can you do that?
This apartment building is using one of the biggest alarm companies in Europe. We established a back door into their servers a couple years ago when we were doing an op in Paris. I can get in, turn the cams off, or just pan them out of the way so they don't see you when you come in.
That's awesome, Ryan said. Let's shut them down while we're inside. Gavin slid to his laptop and let his fingers hover over the keys. He looked up.
What about me?
You're not just going to leave me here by myself, are you?
Dom rolled his eyes, but Jack said, You'll be fine, Gav. We need you to monitor the entrance to the building and listen to your headset. We'll remain in comms so you can let us know if Scala shows up while we're in his place.
What will you do if he does show up?
Ryan answered, We'll improvise.
Gavin didn't like this one bit. That was plain from the look on his face. But he grabbed his laptop off the table and took his seat at the tripod-mounted binoculars. Here, with the computer in his lap, he could see the view from the camera on the roof, as well as through the binos. Plus, he could hear any noise on the laser mic and the directional boom mic, as well as listen in to all comms from Jack and Dominic. The two men put hats on their heads and sunglasses over their eyes, and they headed for the door. Before they left, Jack turned back to Gavin. If you see anything out of the ordinary, you let us know.
Got it, Beery replied, with an intensity in his voice that sounded to the two operators as if Gavin himself was going to be the one to break into the target location.
Chapter 23
Annette Brawley arrived at work early this morning. She'd left a sweet and apologetic note for her daughter on the kitchen table next to a box of Cheerios and a cereal bowl and a spoon. She even picked a Gerber daisy out of the flower pot on the back patio and put it in a tiny vase to go with the table setting. She knew, without a doubt, that Stephanie would ignore the flower and crumple up the sweet note and throw it in the trash. She probably would have done this anyway, but Annette suspected the focus for Stephanie's anger this morning would be the fact that her mother had left an alarm clock at the bottom of the stairs to her room, meaning when it went off, she would have to get up and storm downstairs to turn it off. It wasn't as sure a method for getting her daughter up for school as being there in person to annoy her, but Annette needed to get to the office early to look at a new set of SAT images, so it was the best method available to her. By 7 a.m., Annette had been at it for an hour already. She had made it her personal mission to somehow identify the visiting workers at the new Chongju rare earth processing plant just north of the mine. This was hard work. The resolution provided by the KH-12 satellite in orbit over North Korea was impressive. In just the right conditions, she could make out a license plate, although it was extraordinarily rare that she'd been lucky enough to have the conditions in place when she needed a tag number. But determining the identity of a group of 150 or so men from outer space was no easy task. She had a couple working assumptions going. For one, she decided these workers were not North Korean. They were definite security measures around the temporary housing compound near the hotel in Chongju. North Korea, of course, subjected its own citizens to positively Orwellian levels of scrutiny and security protocols, but this looked more like an armed camp inside a North Korean city. Annette decided if these were local workers,
They wouldn't have that number of guards, guns, and gates around them.
No, these were foreign workers.
But foreign workers from where?
She wasn't able to identify any obvious Caucasians or blacks among the few people standing around the trailers. Everyone she saw looked Asian, but it was impossible to tell if these were North Korean minders or workers from another Asian country. Of course, if they were workers from another country, China would be the first assumption, if not for the fact North Korea had kicked out their Chinese partners more than a year earlier. She kept hunting, using her three monitors to look at each trash bin, each vehicle, each piece of clothing as closely as possible. At 8 a.m., she thought she had something, and by 8:15 the excitement of tangible results coursed through her like electric shocks. Colonel Peters, Annette's boss, arrived at work at 8:30 a.m. to find Annette Brawley standing by his locked door with a smile on her face and two fresh cups of coffee in her hands. His smile in return was more perfunctory. "Morning, Brawley. Any chance I can have a couple minutes to myself before you waylay me with a PowerPoint?" She replied like a schoolgirl. "Please, I just need a few minutes." He sighed. "Will I be impressed?" Positively floored. "Come on, then," he said, and he opened the door to let Brawley in. Peters had just set his briefcase down on his desk when Annette Brawley placed his coffee down, spun his computer to her, and began opening a PowerPoint loaded on the department server to put up on his wall screen. While doing so, she said, "I know who is working at the rare earth metal refinery." She put up a picture of the temporary housing in Chungju. She'd highlighted several guard posts on the outside with red circles. "So first we see there are guards facing out and facing in. Looks like two-way security. They don't want the locals meeting with these folks, which means they aren't locals." "I'll buy that," Peters said. She changed the slide. Now it showed some sort of kitchen facility. Wood-burning stoves, women walking with pots. "Here is the mess area for the guest workers. It's open-pit fires with grills on them. Outdoor lean-to structures. Water tanks."
"Right," said Peters. "No refrigeration. Nasty."
"Yeah, for us anyhow, but not for them. Much of the Third World doesn't refrigerate their meat. My daughter would gag if I told her that, but some of the things she eats makes me want to puke."
Another red circle was around a stack of square objects near the fire.
"What's that?" he asked. "Are those chicken coops?"
"Nope," she said, and she clicked again, enlarging the area. Peters leaned forward. They were definitely cages, each one approximately 2 feet square, based on a woman standing next to them. The Marine colonel tried to look inside. After a few seconds, he said,
"Wait, are those dogs?"
"Yes, they are," she said. 20 crates here, 20 dogs. This image is from 24 hours ago. She clicked the mouse and the next picture came up. It was of the same area. "And here is that mess facility, just 6.5 hours ago." Peters counted. 8 of the crates are gone. The guest workers ate Fido and his friends for dinner.
"So, the guest workers are Korean.
Koreans eat dogs sometimes, don't they?"
"They do.
But so do some other Asian cultures. Vietnam, Indonesia, Taiwan, and China."
"Well, we know they aren't Chinese."
"No, sir. We know they aren't anyone else but Chinese. Only the Chinese have experience with rare earth processing. None of the other countries deal in this industry at all."
Now Peters cocked his head.
"But China was kicked out."
Brawley smiled broadly.
"The Chinese state-owned metal mining corporations, Chinalco and Minmetals, were kicked out. But what I have determined is that these guest workers are Chinese gangster miners."
"Gangster miners?"
"Yes. There are illegal mining companies working all over the country."
"How do you know?"
She clicked to the next slide.
This is a rare earth mine in Mongolia. It's a gangster mine run by an illegal outfit out of Shanghai. This image is from last August. The mine was full of people, cars, trucks, earth-moving equipment. This mine has been underproducing for a few years, but they kept it open, digging out what they could. 350 or so workers, based on the housing. She switched to the next slide, and the next, and the next. They all showed the same mine and surrounding buildings. The only difference was the date in the upper left corner changed. October, December, February. She clicked to bring up the next image from April. Peters looked at it for a moment and said, "I'll be damned." Annette grinned. "Where did everyone go, boss?" "To North Korea? To Cheongju?" "Damn right," she said. "The gangster miners must have been hired in secret by the North Korean state-run mining industry because they didn't have the expertise to operate the mine themselves. Same with the processing facility. The only difference there is the Chinese will need to somehow get some workers with experience in that. The existing gangster mines don't process their own ore." Peters stood up from his desk. He had not even taken a sip of his coffee. "We need to run this up to the fifth floor. Even though it's a little early to present the director with stories about dog meat, they'll need to see this right away." "We," she said. "I look like crap." "You look tired, Brawley. Like you've been working your ass off. That's a good thing. I might have to rumple myself up a little before we go so you don't make me look bad." He said it with a smile. "You couldn't if you tried, boss." Chapter 24. The breach of Karl Skala's apartment building on Christianova Street in Prague took place at 2 p.m. It went smoothly. An old man exited the building just as Ryan and Caruso walked up the steps, and they caught the door before it closed. Once inside, they moved to the right, sticking close to the wall, and then they stepped into the stairwell without anyone noticing them. The stairs were empty at this time of the afternoon, so they came out onto the fifth floor, still undetected. They made their way down to Karl Skala's door, and Ryan knocked while Dom sized up the lock. After a second and third knock, Ryan nodded to Dom and stepped out of the way. While Dom dropped to his knees and began working on the lock, Ryan watched up the hallway, keeping his eyes trained on the stairwell. The elevator bank was closer than the stairs, but Jack knew he'd hear anyone coming via elevator long before the doors slid open. No, their main concern now was the possibility of a neighbor coming out of one of the five other apartments on this floor, or else the stairwell on the far end of the hallway flying open. No words were exchanged between the two men. Ryan wanted to tell his cousin to hurry the fuck up, but he fought the urge. He knew Dom would defeat the lock faster than he could, so he forced himself to be patient. Finally, Jack heard the click of the latch opening, and then he followed his cousin through the door. The small entryway was dark and unremarkable, and this led to an equally dark hallway about 20 feet long. Halfway down on the right was an archway, and they found this led to a well-appointed living room. There was not a single light on in the small apartment, so Jack flipped on a lamp by a sofa so they could look around. Everything was neat and undisturbed. Both men sniffed the air, trying to decide if anyone might be in the apartment, but neither man detected any particular smell. They split up and did a quick but careful walkthrough to make sure the place was unoccupied. Then they met in the living room. Dom spoke softly. "An office in back. No computer. Guest bedroom is empty as well." Jack said, "Master bedroom off the right here. Lot of junk lying around. It'll take a little while to search this place. Let's snoop around. I'll start in the office. You start in the bedroom." He then called Gavin. "Gavin, everything okay?" Gavin Beery replied from his overwatch position. "All's well outside." Jack re-entered the master bedroom and looked for anything interesting out in the open, but that didn't take long. Skala looked like he lived the life of a regular educated European male in his late 20s. There were clothes lying around, books and magazines on his bed, some cheap art on the wall.
The guy obviously liked to play squash. There were rackets and other gear lying on a shelf, and a picture of Scala posing on a squash court and holding a trophy rested on his dresser, next to the small trophy itself. Jack stepped into the master bathroom and went through the medicine cabinets, noted the man had what appeared to be a prescription to combat male pattern baldness, and a large bottle of over-the-counter medicine to treat an upset stomach. On the other side of the apartment, Don combed through the office. He didn't speak or read Czech, so he couldn't identify any of the papers or notes on Scala's little desk. But nothing looked terribly interesting. He felt around under the desk, pulled out the drawers, and looked for false compartments, and he searched behind the bookshelves of the small office. When he came up empty in this room, he went into a guest room and checked under the bed, then stepped into the bathroom and started searching there. In Scala's bedroom, Jack opened the closet and saw Scala had an impressive array of suits on one side, and on the far side, in the back of the closet, a long row of winter coats were pressed together tightly. Jack decided this would be a great place to hide a safe, or anything else Scala wanted to keep hidden, so he began feeling around through the coats. While he searched for any sort of a safe or hidden door, Dom called from the kitchen. "We can plant a bug in here, but we'll just have to come back and get it if he doesn't show up before we leave." Jack felt play in a board in the back wall of the closet. He yanked a few coats off the rod and dropped them to the floor to reveal a loose piece of wallboard a foot and a half wide and several feet tall. He started to pull on it, and while doing so, he said, "Hey, cuz, check this out. I might have a..." The large board peeled back easily, and behind it knelt a pale white man in his underwear. His eyes were red but wide, and he held a large metal object in his hand. The man screamed and raised the metal object.
"What the..."
Jack leapt back in surprise, which worked to his advantage, because the man jumped out from his hiding place swinging. Jack rolled backward across the bed, ended up on his feet against the shelf with the squash equipment on it. The attacker came forward, leapt up on the bed, and raised the weapon high to swing it down. It was a brass lamp, big and heavy, and the man wielded it like a two-handed sword.
"Wait!"
Ryan shouted, but the man swung again as he jumped off the bed. Ryan spun out of the way and felt the breeze as the brass lamp whipped by his face. Ryan heard his cousin shout from the kitchen. "Jack?" Ryan didn't have time to answer. He stumbled back over the dresser as the man closed quickly, chasing Jack with the heavy blunt object. He swung again, but Jack managed to fall backward out of the bedroom and into the hall before the lamp connected. He rolled to the left and shouted at the man again. This time he said, "Scala, wait!" Dom Caruso turned into the hallway from the kitchen, his pistol already out of its thunderwear holster. Scala swung at the gun before Caruso could fire, and the brass lamp in Scala's hand clanged against the steel and polymer weapon, knocking it out of Caruso's hand. Caruso leapt back to avoid a second swing, but then he moved in quickly, got between the attacker and his weapon, and he slammed the man hard up against the wall of the hallway. The brass lamp clanged to the hardwood floor, and Dom shoved the man again. The back of his head made violent contact with the wall. He slid down to the floor, dazed, and Dom stepped over him, fists balled and ready to break his jaw with a right cross. Jack shouted, "No! Don't hurt him! It's Scala!" Dom looked at the man's face for a second. Then he relaxed his hands, turned, and went to retrieve his pistol. Jack stood up and looked down at the dazed man in his underwear. "You speak English?" The Czech man was only 28, but his blonde hair was wispy thin. His eyes were impossibly bloodshot, and he smelled like sweat and urine. Jack's first impression was the man was some sort of a drug addict. Scala nodded slowly.
"Yes."
"What the fuck were you doing in your closet?" Jack asked. He coughed a few times. His throat sounded as dry as paper.
"Hiding from you bastards."
"How did you know we were here?" This confused the man, it was plain to see. He rubbed his eyes.
"You... aren't you with the North Koreans?"
Caruso holstered his pistol. He was pissed at losing his weapon in a fight with a man with more luck than training,
and his anger was reflected in his voice. He snapped back, "Do we fucking look like we're with the North Koreans?" Jack added, "We're American." Scala said,
"So? The last American I talked to was working with the North Koreans."
Hazelton, Jack thought, but he did not say it. Instead, he said, "We're not with the North Koreans. Are they after you?" Scala just nodded. He was still coming out of his daze, and he was plainly afraid. Jack said, "We're going to sit down in the living room and talk a minute. We have a man outside, and we're in communication with him. He'll tell us if anybody else shows up." This seemed to relax Scala a little.
"I would very much like to have a beer," he said.
While Dom went to the kitchen to get Scala a beer from the refrigerator, Jack went into the bedroom and looked at the little spider hole in the back of the closet. It was 2 feet wide and 5 feet tall, and only a foot and a half deep, smaller than a casket, and certainly just as dark. The North Koreans had this guy spooked enough to virtually bury himself alive in his own home, and this realization chilled Ryan. Inside the hole, Ryan found Scala's mobile phone and a laptop. There was a battery charger plugged into both devices. Jack took it all out and headed back for the living room. Here he found Dom standing with a beer in his hand. Scala was in the bathroom urinating, but Dom made him leave the door open so he could be sure he wasn't trying to escape through the little window high in the wall. When Scala finished in the bathroom, he came out and sat on his couch across from an archway that led to the hallway to the front door. Dom gave him his beer, then sat next to him. Jack sat in the chair on Scala's left. Jack asked, "How long have you been in your wall?" The man looked down at his watch for a second, then he said,
"Almost 2.5 days. I came out at night for a few minutes to walk around and use the toilet."
"Who are you hiding from?" He didn't answer the question. Instead, he asked, "Who are you?" "A friend of ours met you at the airport. He wanted us to look you up."
"What friend?"
"Colin Hazelton." Scala didn't react to the name at all. Jack said, "Big American, early 60s.
"Yes," he said with a nod. "So, if you are friends with him, you are working with..."
Dom interrupted. "We told you we're not with anybody. Somebody killed Hazelton. We think it might have been the North Koreans. We're here to find out why."
"They killed him," Scala said softly.
He didn't seem surprised, but the weight of the words affected him. He chugged a third of the bottle of beer. His terror was greater even than his exhaustion, and his hands trembled. Jack said, "You gave Hazelton some documents." Scala nodded.
"Yes. 5 sets of papers. EU diplomatic passports and Czech travel authorizations."
"You still have copies of them?"
"No. I deleted everything."
He shrugged.
"Of course I did. I didn't want to get caught with it."
Jack winced in frustration. "Who were the people?"
"I don't know. I was given photographs. I made everything else up."
"Where were they from?"
"I don't have any idea. I guess they are Americans, because the American was the one who paid me and picked up the documents."
Jack shrugged. He wasn't so sure. He asked, "And where were they going?" Scala cocked his head.
"North Korea. Of course. I created paperwork claiming them to be Czech diplomats traveling to the mission in Pyongyang."
Jack said, "Somebody killed Hazelton in Vietnam and took the documents. But I don't know who, and I don't know why. I don't even know if they made it to North Korea." Scala surprised Ryan by saying,
"They made it."
"How do you know that?"
"Because the North Koreans themselves came here last week. They said they needed paperwork to get more people into North Korea. They offered big money. Said over time there would be dozens traveling. I tried to explain to them how dangerous it was for me, I almost got caught with the last batch of 5 I created. There was no way I would be able to pull off forging that many. But they wouldn't listen. They got threatening. They were animals. I had no idea anything like this would happen. Don snorted. So when you agreed to work with the North Koreans, you never imagined you might be working with the North Koreans. He shrugged. Sometimes I work for an organization in the U.S. that needs forged EU passports. Sharp's global intelligence partners, Jack asked. Scala nodded.
Yes. They are the ones who came to me. I thought this would be the same as ever, but the man wanted the North Korean letters as well. I was surprised. I thought it was just for some cover story. I didn't think they actually would be traveling there. The American paid me twice my normal rate, so I agreed.
This was Hazelton?
No, another man, an Englishman. 30s, very polite. A pleasure to work with.
Then what happened?
The day before I had them ready, he called me. He'd taken ill. Something he ate, he said, so another man from his company would meet me at the airport to collect them. I was told to package them up in a way he could not see the contents. This man was your friend, the big American. He took the documents and left. I thought that was the end of it. Then North Koreans from the embassy here came, and they told me if I didn't agree to work with them, they would kill me. I agreed, but said I needed to wait a day before getting access to the passport printing equipment. I used that day to hide.
Why didn't you run away? Why stay here?
I wanted to run, of course. But I couldn't think of any place I could go without using friends for help. I was afraid of involving anyone else. They would have learned about the forgery. Anyway, I thought the North Koreans would give up after a day or two. But they didn't, did they? They came back, 2 nights ago. I was in my hiding place. I know it was them. I heard their voices. Of course, I don't speak their language, but they sounded like the same men. They were here for a long time, but they didn't find me.
Ryan looked around the room.
Wait. They were in your apartment?
Yes. All over. He and Dom exchanged a look. Scala saw the look.
What?
Dom just said, shit.
What's wrong?
Jack stood back up. They might have left a listening device. Something that would let them know if you came back. He turned away from Scala and called Beery.
Gav, we still okay out there?
Beery replied confidently.
Quiet as a tomb.
Okay, Ryan replied. We'll be moving in 5 minutes. Eyes peeled.
Roger.
Seconds later, in the office building on nearby Baranova Street, Gavin Beery launched out of his chair. A knock at the door to the office made him jump up and spin around. He didn't answer at first. He sat back down and willed whoever it was to go away, because he had a job to do and didn't want to let the guys down. Another knock. He started to call Jack and Dom back, but he stopped himself. He would just ignore the knocking. He had wanted to be involved in field work, after all. He couldn't let Dom and Jack know he spooked every time someone rapped on the door. Another set of knocks came, but he focused his attention through the binoculars at the street below Scala's apartment to make sure nothing was going on. He heard the rattling of keys now, and a key sliding into the lock of the door. He figured it was just the superintendent of the building, a woman named Greta. She'd come by once before and shaken her keys like that. He leapt to his feet and ran to the door. Even though Jack had placed a rubber door stopper to keep the door closed, Gavin figured if Greta couldn't get in, she'd immediately start making problems. On his way through the kitchen, though, he picked up a steak knife just in case and slid it under the cuff of his shirt.
Just as he did so, the door opened, and he saw Greta entering alone. She was an older woman. She'd walked the men through the property when they arrived the day before, and he knew she was no threat. Under her arm, he saw a square air filter. The woman didn't speak English, but she was nice enough. With hand gestures and smiles, she indicated what she wanted to do, and Gavin followed her through the large open office. When she wasn't looking, he pulled the knife from the cuff of his shirt and placed it on a desk. Then he quickly caught up with her. The space in the corner of the big room where the campus men had set up their surveillance was hidden from the rest of the room by stacked desks. But the heavyset American also positioned his body between his hindsight and the woman while she opened the heating unit in a back utility closet. Soon she was finished, and she headed for the kitchen and the exit with Gavin carefully walking alongside her. As she walked, she looked around with some curiosity, Gavin noticed, but he imagined she was just wondering what the hell the Americans were doing here in the space. There was nothing on any of the desks, and other than a few water bottles and groceries in the kitchen and the one tenant walking oddly close to her, there was no sign of any activity in the unit. At the door, Greta turned to try to communicate with Gavin. Normally he would have been helpful and done his part to bridge the language gap, but he knew he had to get back to his Overwatch, so he just stood there, silent and more than a little annoyed-looking. Eventually, she gave up. With a frustrated smile, she said, "Everything okay?" "Yes. Okay, Greta. Everything is very okay. Goodbye." "Goodbye," she said, and Gavin closed the door inches from her smiling face. He turned and ran through the warehouse office, made it back around the desks and to his Overwatch, and looked into the binoculars mounted on the tripod. Thankfully, he saw no movement at the front of the apartment on Christianova. He blew out a long sigh that was interrupted two-thirds of the way through when he gasped, "Wait." A gray van was parked in the parking lot next to the apartment. Gavin had been looking at this same area for most of the past day. That van definitely had not been there before. He squinted into the binos, and through the windshield of the van, he could see a lone man behind the wheel. This didn't look good. He connected with Ryan by hitting his PTT button in his pocket. "Ryan?" He heard someone push their own transmit button, but immediately he heard a shout in his headset. It was the unmistakable voice of Jack Ryan Jr. "Gun!" The muffled thump of a gunshot followed a heartbeat later. Chapter 25. The team that hit Scala's house weren't Tier 1 operators, but they were well-motivated, and as far as Jack Ryan was concerned, there sure were a goddamn lot of them. The Czech Republic's diplomatic relations with the DPRK meant North Korea had an embassy in Prague, although it was just a small, squat, red brick building way out west of the city in the suburban 6th District. But even though it was small and spare, it was staffed at any one time with more than a dozen members of Ri Tae-jin's Reconnaissance General Bureau's spies, and another dozen military security forces who did any work for RGB that was required. That meant 24 men were available for Ri's mission in-country, and one of those missions meant hunting for one Karel Skala, a Czech consular official with the ability to create travel documents to get scientists out of the West and into North Korea in furtherance of the DPRK's fledgling rare earth minerals industry. Skala had gone into hiding. Most of the RGB officers at the embassy thought he'd fled the country, but when they paid a visit to his home two nights earlier, they left a hidden microphone behind his television set, and 20 minutes ago, when English-speaking voices were heard by the embassy RGB communications staff, the order came for a team of 6 North Korean security agents to race to the building to see what was happening. While they were on the way, they received a second call from their superior. This one notified them that Skala himself was in the building. He was talking to the Americans, discussing his relationship with North Korea, and suddenly their job changed from a capture mission to a kill mission. Only 5 of the men were armed. They carried CZ pistols, 9mm weapons of a local manufacturer. The other man was the driver. He, like the others, had military martial arts training and basic surveillance skills given to him by his nation's spy services before he moved into the foreign posting. And more than firepower, the main weapon the North Koreans had was incentive. Failing their mission right now would be failing the Daewon Su, and all of these men knew the penalty for this could be their lives or the lives of their families. They would go up to that 5th-floor apartment and rip the 3 men there apart, limb from limb, if necessary. But they were determined not to go back to the embassy without getting the job done. Caruso had stepped back into the master bedroom of Scala's apartment to grab the young man a set of clothes. He and Ryan wanted the Czech man dressed and out of the building quickly, in case the North Koreans had bugged the place. But Scala himself was still dazed from exhaustion and the blow to the head, and Dom decided it would take Scala longer to get himself together than either he or Jack wanted to wait. So Dom just randomly grabbed pants and shoes and a shirt, and then threw toiletries along with other odds and ends into a bag he found on a shelf. Ryan stood watch over Scala next to the entryway to the hall. The Czech consular official sat on his sofa facing the archway next to Ryan, which meant he was in the right position to have seen the men filing into the apartment first if he had only been looking in the right direction. Instead, his attention had been focused on the floor in front of him and the dizziness in his head. He did look up just in time to see 2 men in the archway. They were plainly Korean, and they were just 2 meters or so from the bearded American leaning against the wall, although they had not seen him yet. Scala blinked hard at the image. Then he started to stand. Ryan was in the process of taking a call from Gavin Beery when he saw the movement and the astonished expression on Scala's face, and he turned to see what had him so terrified. Jack saw only the tip of a handgun as it aimed through the archway on his left. He leapt toward it instinctively, tried to grab it or knock it away from its target. "Gun!" he shouted. The weapon fired. Ryan folded his right hand over the hot barrel, and his left arm swung in a wide haymaker. He connected with the side of a man's head. He hadn't even focused his eyes on the assailant, because his attention was still on the pistol. A second gunshot cracked in the hallway of the apartment a few feet to his left. Ryan sensed, rather than saw, a large group of men bursting through the doorway there, and to keep himself out of the line of fire from their weapons, he swung his now unconscious victim around so the man's limp body would be positioned between himself and the attackers. Another shot came from less than 10 feet away, and Ryan immediately felt the small man in his arms jolt. He'd been shot in the back. Ryan wanted to get his gun out of its thunderwear holster and into the fight. He knew he could do it in 1 second in optimal conditions, but he was standing at one end of a hallway that was full of gunmen at the other end, protected only by a wounded or dead man held up in his arms. 1 second was an eternity in this situation, dropping his cover to jam his hand down the front of his pants to pull out his Smith & Wesson would certainly just result in him getting gunned down with his hand stuck down the front of his pants. Shouting men filed up the hall, and a third booming handgun report sounded in the small space. The man in Ryan's arms jerked again, and Jack crouched tighter. He decided he'd have to at least try for his gun. But just as he let the man in his arms go to do this, out of the corner of his left eye he saw Dominic Caruso running into the living room from the back bedroom, his small black pistol high in a combat grip and pointed to the wall, behind which it looked like at least 4 or 5 North Koreans stood engaging Ryan, unaware of the man on their right. Dominic couldn't see any targets, but he could see his cousin crouched low with a spasming, bleeding man in his arms, and he heard the direction the last gunshot came from. He aimed his weapon to a point waist-high on the wall between himself and the hallway, and he pressed the trigger once, twice, 3 times, moving his aim laterally to the left toward the doorway while he moved his body laterally right toward his cousin and a better view of what was in the hall. ejected cartridges from his pistol, arced through the air, and bounced on the floor of the living room while he moved. After 5 rounds, he saw puffs of masonry and wallboard above his point of aim, and this told him the shooters there realized they were under fire from an unseen assailant on the other side of the wall, and they had begun shooting back. Dom crouched lower and kept moving across the living room. He crossed in front of the crumpled body of Carl Scala on the floor in front of the sofa. He fired 9 rounds just as he stepped into the hallway, his weapon locked open as he pulled the trigger on the back of a North Korean fleeing through the door, out of the apartment, and into the hall that ran down the spine of the building. It appeared more than one assailant had retreated into the main hall, but there were 2 bodies lying still on the floor by the door, plus the dead man at Ryan's feet. Dom stepped in front of Ryan, who was now down on one knee and drawing his weapon. Dom's gun was empty, so he started to draw his one spare magazine from his Thunderwear holster. While doing so, however, he saw a North Korean lean back around into view from the main hallway, his pistol rising in front of him.
"Down!"
Dom heard from behind, and he dropped flat on his chest. Jack Ryan rose from his crouch over his cousin, his Smith & Wesson M&P shield barking in his hand. The North Korean caught a 9mm hollow point round right in the forehead, an inch left of center, and he tumbled back, his pistol spinning through the air and bouncing into the hallway. After the gun settled and Jack's hot brass finished spinning on the floor, it was eerily quiet in the apartment. The smell of gun smoke was pervasive, and a heavy blue tinge hung in the air, the result of 20 or so rounds being fired from multiple weapons in such a small enclosed space. One of the men lying in front of Jack moved. His head lifted a little, and he reached out for a pistol lying on the legs of a dead man next to him. Jack fired once, hitting the man in the back of the neck. Blood sprayed down the hall with the impact of the round. Jack kept his gun trained on the open doorway. He said, "I count 4 down. How many more?" Caruso reloaded quickly.
"How the fuck should I know? I just got here."
Jack looked over to Scala now.